Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. As we move into the holiday season, my guest today offers a comprehensive primer for the budding wine drinker as well as the experienced wine consumer. When Melanie Wagner first entered the wine business, there's an awful lot of pretension and snobbiness around the world of wine. Very few ways to learn the ins and outs of wine that didn't come at your own expense. But over the years, that's changed. Well, just a little. My guess is trying to help. Today, Melanie Wagner is a Chicago-based certified sommelier and wine writer and the author of Hello Wine, The Most Essential Things You Need to Know About Wine. It's published by Chronicle Books. The book covers the basics and gets as technically detailed as you would like about the winemaking process, how they're made today, about varietal types, wine-food pairings, underappreciated and best value wines, a buying guide, a glossary, a list of necessary equipment, and how-tos, how to taste, how to throw a wine party, and how to start a tasting group. She joins us today by phone here on Studio Tulsa. Melanie Wagner, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Hi, Rich. Thank you.
This book, Hello Wine, you really go through all the aspects of the world of wine. Why did you decide to write this book?
I came into wine in kind of a strange way. I didn't come from a wine-drinking family. I moved to San Francisco right after college, and I was a preschool teacher. And people like to joke that the kids drove me to drink, but truly, I just needed to make more money in San Francisco. I couldn't afford to live there on a teacher's salary. So I had this epiphany conversation with one of the little boys in my class, his mother, on the playground one day. And she said she sold wine, and I thought that that sounded like the most glamorous and wonderful job that I never knew existed. And so I made up my mind that I, too, was going to sell wine because I thought I could make more money doing that, and I really wanted to learn about wine. I didn't know very much. I tell you that background because I think it is a very important part of my voice in the book and also why I wrote the book, because my first few years in the wine business in San Francisco, which is obviously a very sophisticated wine market. And I was met with wine snobs everywhere. And it was like the people that I was working with were making fun of me. The people that I was selling to were making fun of me. The people that I was, my competitors were making fun of me. And I couldn't understand why, if our common goal was to get people drinking more wine, why people wouldn't be a little bit more friendly about sharing information and just being more kind and welcoming when people are first getting into wine. And so I was not thinking about writing a book way back then. That was 10 years ago. But I was definitely formulating this ideology in my head that people needed a warm hug when they come into wine, for lack of a better word. They needed to feel the way that I felt once I knew wine, once I really knew wine. Wine is not snobby at all. Wine is one of the most humble things in the world. It's born of the earth. And in Europe, they don't treat wine the way we treat it here with such status. It's just an everyday part of the meal. And so that's what I really was trying to accomplish with the book, is trying to make people feel warm and welcome and comfortable, but also provide really authoritative information of how they can apply wine in everyday life.
I want to ask you, why does the world of American wine try so hard to make it difficult to understand the ins and outs of wine? And really that goes to the worldwide industry, from everything from labels in certain countries to just, again, that snobby issue and the idea that there's some mystique. And I think that's probably it. It's this misguided sense that there's a mystique to wine as opposed to something that can be enjoyed as just a part of everyday living.
Right. I think on the label issue, I think labels that are hard to read and hard to understand, some of the hardest to read and hardest to understand are places that have been making wine for thousands of years and their labels are still the same. So I wouldn't say that those people are necessarily trying to be snotty or make wine mysterious. They're just sort of traditionally set in their own ways of making wine. And I talk a lot about that in the book, about the old world of wine versus the new world and why labels are the way that they are.
And in fact, in the old world, a lot of times it has to do with regulations, too. I mean, they're regulated by what they put on.
It does. I was trying not to get too technical there. But, yeah, I mean, wine labels from Burgundy are notoriously hard to understand. They're cryptic looking. They have lots of different pieces of information on them. And unless you know all of the villages or a lot of the villages of Burgundy, it's very tough to, you know, navigate your way around a wine label from there. But if you think back, you know, 5,000 years ago, when they were first making wine there, the village, they only work with really two grape varieties in Burgundy, Chardonnay and Pinot Noir. So that's the easiest thing to understand about Burgundy. But if you were making Chardonnay, if you were making white wine in Burgundy thousands of years ago, and that's all your village grew, and that's all the neighboring villages grew, and you were only making wine for yourself or your neighbor or maybe, you know, your cousins down the way, you weren't making wine for a global market. You had no reason to put the grape name on the label because everybody knew that everybody around those parts grew Chardonnay.
The distinction was the village and the vineyard within the village.
Yes, that was a much more important piece of information to people as far as what the wine would taste like. But of course, now in the New World, we've gotten used to having grape varieties on the label. So we look at a label from Burgundy and say, oh my gosh, it doesn't even have the grape name on here.
Right. Well, let's talk a little bit about the American world of wine, because this is where a lot of the snobbery comes in and this idea of mystique. And I think it's almost like a misplaced marketing of this is a secret world that, you know, if you enter it and explore it, you'll have, you know, it'll be a great experience, but you have to learn it. And it's almost like a trial and error method, which seems to be counterproductive.
It's luxury. It's selling luxury. In this country, we're selling luxury when we're selling wine, for the most part, when we're selling fine wine. And that's definitely something that you don't get in Europe. The English buy luxury wines also, but for the most part in Italy and France, Italy, for example, the most expensive wines from Italy are consumed by Americans. Brunello di Montalcino, Barolo, Barbaresco, we buy those wines. Which is interesting, I think, when I tell Italian wine lovers that live here in the United States, the Italians drink Barbera a lot of times, which is a grape that is not really very expensive usually. It's juicy, it's fresh, it's meant to go with food, or they just drink wine that they made from grapes in their front yard because the Italians' version of the front yard is their little vineyard. They don't have a lawn. They have vines growing in their yard, and every part of Italy is packed with vineyards. Or in a lot of countries in Europe, you take your big jug down to the area where you're getting your wine and you just fill up your jug of wine and you bring it back and that's what you have for dinner for the week. So it's definitely, wine is a lot less pretentious in the old world and they drink a lot more than we do. We have a lot of catching up to do. But maybe it's because our wine is so expensive and considered elitist, you know?
Now, of course, technology and places like the University of California, Davis, which has a whole winemaking program there, has that changed much the way wine is made?
UC Davis, I think, was really helpful in California's beginning wine industry. And most, I mean, 20 years ago, most of the people that you talk to who are making wine in California were trained at UC Davis. You know, it has been training ground for lots and lots of really important, groundbreaking winemakers and wineries in California and Oregon and Washington. But there's been a little bit of a pendulum swing away from the really, really analytical style of winemaking and sort of a turn back to more European or traditional style winemaking where it's a little bit more by the senses than by the numbers.
And doing the old,
if that makes sense.
Yeah, and it does a lot of the old traditional things like pruning, like in a what's shaping up to be a bad vintage. You do a lot of pruning of the vineyard so you get the best flavor for what you have. But I would think technology's also changed the old world, because one of the things that's happened is the vintages have all evened out. You know, a great vintage is still a great vintage, but
yeah.
But a rainy vintage, and of course rain is terrible for grapes when you're harvesting them because it dilutes the sugars.
Yeah, technology, it's great that we have the benefit of both the old school and the new school because we can reap the benefits of both of those things. Of course, technology and innovation and creativity that comes with the new world has led to lots of improvements like screw caps, like stainless steel fermentation tanks, which allow you to make wine at a cooler temperature, which is better for quality and gives you more control over how slowly the fermentation happens, which means better wine. So, yeah, it's good to have both, and it's good to drink both, old world and new world wines.
You just mentioned screw caps. That's one of your wine myths. I think it's changing now that Screw caps are not putting off people like they were, but from cork as a bottler. But this is one of the wine myths that you write about in the book.
Yes, I'm a huge fan of screw caps, and there's definitely a myth that only cheap wines come with screw caps. And that was probably my favorite chapter writing, was chapter 2. And I debunk all the wine myths that are just prevalent and out there that I've heard all my life, and many other people have fallen for too. And the only reason why people don't switch to screw caps right now, and by people I mean every winery everywhere, is because they think that you'll think their wine is cheap. And the reason why they should skip to screw caps is because there are a lot of things that can go bad with a bottle of wine, but the thing that happens most of the time, I would say 90% of the time, is that you get a corked bottle. And the nomenclature is a little misleading because it doesn't mean that the bottle is enclosed with a cork. It means that the cork and subsequently the wine has been infected with a chemical compound called TCA or trichloranisole, and it has a very distinct smell. It makes your wine smell like musty, wet cardboard. And I guarantee anybody listening to this who, you know, drinks wine on a fairly regular basis has had a wine that has been corked or had this TCA flaw, because they say one in every 12 bottles of wine has it. And I can't imagine any other industry, can you, Rich, that would allow that much of their product go out with a default.
Yeah, and of course there's also, I guess there are rubber corks that are sort of,
I can't stand those. I think they're really hard to get out of the bottle, and then if you don't finish a bottle, they're really hard to get back in. Plus, they're a little bit more expensive, so they add a little cost to the bottle. So I say just get over losing the romance of popping the cork and switch to screw caps whenever you can, because it ensures that you're going to have a clean, fresh-tasting bottle of wine, and also encourages those that aren't putting screw caps on their wine to go ahead and take the plunge and do it.
Now, the first wine myth in that little section was that expensive wine is always great wine. And, of course, expensive wine can be great wine, but the whole thing is it can be great wine for $10 a bottle.
As I say in the book, sometimes those are my favorite wines because I don't feel guilty and I can drink more of them. And wine is about pleasure. So if a $10 wine makes you happy, then jackpot. I just did a book signing, and we did, as a fun aside, we did a sparkling wine that was from France that was $18, and we did a true champagne from Champagne, France that was $85, and they were both rosés, both sparkling. We tasted them blind, which means I had them in little brown bags, and everybody thought that the $18 wine was more expensive, and I mean, not everybody, but I would say 85% of the audience, and most of them liked that one better. So you really never know. It's harder to find really good wines at a lower price point because there's more factories turning out really processed wine at those prices, but it can be done, and I definitely give a lot of recommendations for my perennial favorite producers of inexpensive wine and also expensive wine in the book. I am a little bit opinionated.
Well, I think you wouldn't be a sommelier if you weren't. My guest today is Melanie Wagner,
right,
a certified sommelier and wine writer. Her new book is titled Hello Wine, The Most Essential Things You Need to Know About Wine. And it tackles every process from how a modern-day winery makes wine to how grapes are cared for, but as well, you know, just the usual things you expect to find, recommendations, descriptions of the various grapes, and the different tastes that each grape is going to provide, as well as the different regions, because Chardonnay in California and Chardonnay in Burgundy can be entirely different animals. Riesling in Germany and Riesling in Washington can be very, very different. And that gets back to the old word of terroir, where the grapes are grown. And you get into that as well.
Oh, yeah. Terroir is an important word. It's kind of a snotty-sounding French word. But basically it means the entire environment that the grape grows up in before it becomes wine. And so that's, of course, soil and subsoil and aspect of the vineyard and how much rainfall does it get during the year and how many hours of sunshine and which direction does the sunshine hit from and what time of day. And all these things might seem little and unimportant, but especially in places that have been making wine for thousands of years and have taken notes and have handed down vineyards from family member to family member, they're actually really important, and they actually do play an important part in how a wine eventually tastes. And I think, you know, we were talking about the old world and the new world. The old world has a really good grasp of this, and the new world is learning to also. We are, if you think about California, I mean, California's only been making wine for a little over 100 years and really hasn't been in their groove, I would say, only has been doing that for maybe 25 or 30. So we're just scratching the surface now. And I guarantee in 100 or 200 years, unfortunately, Rich, we won't be here to drink the wine, but our grandkids might. And they're going to be talking a lot more about terroir, and tiny plots of land are going to be much more heavily delineated in the new world.
Already in California, you're seeing single vineyard bottles of wine and parts of vineyards. But when you get into the old world, there'll be a vineyard along the side of the hill, and there will be a bottling for the lowest part of the hill and the highest part of the hill, because they believe there's big differences in just where the grapes are within the confines of a hillside vineyard.
Yep. More sunshine, more water equals riper grapes equals a riper taste in the wine. And they're not pretending. It's actually a true thing. The same thing with food. I mean, we're seeing that more in food, too. As there are more foodies in this country, we see more delineation with particular types of cheeses and meats and all kinds of things. It's not just wine.
Well, another section in the book that I found really interesting was your Wine 911. First of all, the emergency number one was you don't have a corkscrew and you have a bottle of wine. You're out on a picnic. And I found your very first technique to be just, I'm going to have to try it just to say I've tried this, which is to basically wrap a wine bottle in a jacket or a towel, and you just pound the bottom of the wine bottle against a tree. That'll actually get the cork out?
And the pressure, you have to take the foil off first, but pressure will eventually push the cork out. And you kind of got to be careful not to, like, you know, bang it with all your force, or you could possibly break the bottle. But, yeah, I've done it. It can be done.
Of course, probably the more familiar one is when the cork crumbles or falls apart. You know, our houses are notoriously dry, unless you're properly storing wine. If you've had a bottle of wine for a while, that cork's going to dry out, and it's liable to crumble, and you might have to poke it into the bottle, or you're, you know, trying to get tweezers to get the dang cork out. And you said, you know, get a coffee filter. Filter the wine. That works, too.
Yeah, I try to provide a lot of practical info. I mean, I do talk about the spiritual side of wine and my philosophy on wine and how to buy better and a lot of different things. But I also just wanted to talk to people about, okay, you got a bottle at home and you have these everyday things that happen that a lot of wine experts aren't really talking about, and this is how to gracefully deal with it.
Well,
or not so gracefully. Yeah. But
The coffee filter is probably not the most graceful way, but it works.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about some recommendations. It's the holidays coming up. Perhaps people know somebody who love wine in their family. You have a wonderful little section of 25 wines on a dime. And rather than talk about specific vintners, let's talk about some of the regions of the world that don't get as much play. I know you have several from, I think the Languedoc, which that's become more popular. But what are some of the areas that
I go to for value?
Yeah, exactly.
It changes every now and then. But, I mean, Spain has been a great place for value since I got into the wine business. It seemed like right when I got in, that was sort of Spain was like a hot place to get wines under $10 that were really juicy and ripe and satisfying, spicy tasting. And it still is. Not as much for white wines, but definitely for red wines. I think that Portugal, we're going to see, you know, Portugal is known for its fortified sweet dessert wines.
Ports.
But we are going to see port, yes, exactly. But we are going to see some really incredible dry red wines come out of this area. It's already happening, and people are using those same grapes they used to make the fortified wine, and they are making dry wines. And these wines are averaging $20 a bottle, but they taste like if they came from California or they came from Bordeaux, they would be $60, $70 bottles of wine. They're super high quality. They're really dark and dense and chewy, and they have big structure and lots of, like, drying tannin, real masculine wines, but really incredible values. I think South America has some good values. There's also South American can be hit or miss for me. There's some really outstanding values I've had, and then there's a lot of stuff that you kind of have to wade through, so I think you need to be a little more careful there. And then Southern Italy is another place that I think you can find outrageous values, especially for food wines. I mean, Italy does not make a wine for sitting around and sipping on your front porch. Italy is the heart of gastronomy. And the Italians have a great saying. They say if somebody has had too much to drink, they say, oh, they just haven't had enough to eat yet. And I love that. And I think that really demonstrates their take on wine. But Southern Italy used to be seen kind of the same as Southern France, as this, like, wine lake of really cheap wines that were very low quality. But I think now you're seeing a resurgence of people kind of taking more pride in the traditional grapes that were indigenous to their regions, and they're making higher and higher quality wines, but the prices necessarily aren't very high. So grapes like wines like Nero d'Avola are really superb values. But I talk a lot about those values in the book too.
Yeah, and you know, when I think of Italy, I think of the high dollar wines as being in the Piedmont. That's where the Barolos and Barbarescos are, and then the Tuscans, which is Chianti and Brunello and all that. But what you're seeing is you're seeing more wines coming to the United States from further down the boot, Abruzzi, I guess as far south as Naples and Sicily?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, Nero d'Avola, the one I mentioned, is from Sicily. Mm-hmm. Well, good stuff. Great pizza wines.
My guest today is Melanie Wagner, a certified sommelier and wine writer, and the author of Hello Wine, The Most Essential Things You Need to Know About Wine. Well, you also have a huge section on food-wine pairings. Is there any just essential rules, or are all those rules going by the wayside? I mean, you know, if you have sweet and acidic, maybe, I don't know if that works well or bad, but there are foods that just don't work well together. But a lot of the rules are going by the wayside as far as how you choose a wine with food.
Yeah, I think people are getting more confident in their palates, maybe, and that's something that I definitely try to encourage and say that I hate rules, and I hate rules when it comes to wine, but my first guideline is trust yourself, and if it's something that you like, then don't worry about what anybody else has to say about it, any expert, because they're not in charge of you, and they're not in charge of your tongue, and they don't have to eat your dinner, so, but then, you know, I do say, yes, of course, people like myself who are wine professionals, and we are forced to taste lots and lots of wine, we are going to have some guidance about steering you towards what could possibly be a good combination. And there are limitless numbers of these. I think it's interesting to think about if I assigned a particular meal to 10 of the top sommeliers in the country and asked them what was the perfect wine to pair with it, I guarantee they would all have 10 different wines. But they would all be, I'm sure they would be good pairings. So everybody's got an opinion. Yours is the one that counts the most. That having been said, I think the most important thing that you can consider with pairing food and wine is probably intensity. So we think about, you know, really delicate foods like sushi or scallops, things that have kind of fragile, delicate taste. You wouldn't want to pair something like that with a big, intense Zinfandel or Shiraz or Cabernet or big red wine that's going to clobber that food. And same idea with the opposite way. You wouldn't want to have, like, barbecue ribs with a very light, delicate Pinot Grigio, because you wouldn't be able... I mean, you could do it, but you might as well be drinking water, because you're not going to taste anything in that wine.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, that brings me another question. As a sommelier yourself, when you're going to the wine store, when you're going to a restaurant to order a bottle of wine, what are some of the important questions that you can get the best value as far as, you know, I mean, obviously price is a point, but what are some of the other questions you can ask a sommelier to get the best advice, whether it be buying?
You know what? I wouldn't be afraid of going into a wine shop and saying, this is my budget, whatever it is. Say it's $8, say it's $15, say it's $50. going and saying, okay, this is how much money I wanted to spend. What's the best bottle of wine you've tasted recently for that price? There's no shame at all in doing that. But that having been said, that's going to be their opinion. So whenever you can get better at talking about what it is you like in wine, or even lining up bottles on a shelf for the wine store clerk that you're getting to know at your local wine shop and saying, okay, I don't know why, but I liked this bottle and this bottle and this bottle, and I didn't like this bottle or this bottle. Even if that's all you can tell them, they will be able to amass some great clues from that, and they'll be able to better predict which bottle you're going to like better next.
We're about out of time, but I do want to ask one last question. Of course, the best way to learn about wine is actually tasting it. The second best way to learn about wines is, I think you have some great wine party ideas. Can you share a couple of those in our last minute or two?
Sure. You know, I wrote, the first book I wrote, Rich, was hosting wine parties, because I have a business here in Chicago where I've been helping people host wine parties in their homes for a while, and I wrote a book about that, and that's the book that got me the attention of my literary agent and Chronicle Books, the publisher, and they came back and said, we like this idea, but we don't want to publish this book right now. We want you to write an introduction to wine book because we love how you talk about wine, which I, of course, was thrilled to write. So maybe the follow-up book will be the wine party concept. But I have hosted a lot of wine parties, and I think a great idea is to have a theme and also to open more than one bottle at the same time that have something in common. And an easy way to do this is to look at the back of Hello Wine, and I've got homework six packs in there. So let's say you want to learn more about Cabernet, or you want to learn more about Germany, you can go to the homework six pack about that theme, and you can take that as a shopping list to your favorite wine store and say, okay, this is my budget, I need these six wines, bring them home, and that in itself is a great theme or concept for a wine club or wine tasting party or whatever. You can open several bottles at one time that have a common thread but are a little bit different. You're going to learn so much.
And that can range from a Chardonnay from Sonoma County versus French white Burgundy, or taking a whole...
comparisons are huge.
Yeah, or an area like the Pacific Northwest or Northern Italy, or that Central and Southern Italy area you were talking about earlier. So it is a great
mm-hmm.
idea. Yeah. What's the best bottle of wine you've tasted recently?
You know, I just wrote a blog post on this wine called Wolf Trap. It's from South Africa, and it is a Shiraz Mourvedre Viognier, three grapes, blend, just say a Syrah blend, and it is so delicious for $8 a bottle, and it has a screw cap, and I've had it four or five times over the past few years, and it just keeps getting better, it seems, for pennies.
Yeah, $8 a bottle, that's not bad at all. And it's the name of the vintner is Wolf Trap?
Wolf Trap. Wolf Trap is the name of the wine. The winery name, you don't even want to know. It's hard to pronounce. It's called Buchenhutskloof. But if you just remember Wolf Trap, you'll be safe.
All right. Well, Melanie, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much. Cheers.
Melanie Wagner is a certified sommelier, wine writer, and the author of Hello Wine, The Most Essential Things You Need to Know About Wine. It's published by Chronicle Books. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent programs, they're available online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. I'm Rich Fisher. Stay warm this weekend.